I'm doing something that I don't normally do, and I've already talked to myself about this. Typically, education folks don't read papers. We usually have a PowerPoint, and we just go from that and make comments. So this morning I'm going to read some of the paper, but I'll also be showing slides at various times because I think it's impossible to take it all in from just hearing it. So as we look at this area then, welcome. Introduce yourselves, if you would.
I'm David Grisham, and I'm from Nashville, Tennessee.
All right.
John Pennings.
Very good. I was just apologizing for reading some of this because it's something that education people typically don't do, but we'll try it. If you look at this overall, I'm not sure what your impressions are. My initial thoughts were that I'd be going over rather boring statistics and people whose names were familiar to all of us, and we would cover some dates that were important, and we will do some of that, but we'll do some other things as well. One thing I'll explain early on is that there is a section on Moravians that I never anticipated including in this paper. I've known about them for, I don't know, certainly 35 or 40 years, I guess, but I never realized just exactly how they might touch all of this. And so I apologize for taking quite a bit of time in the middle to talk about them, but they are powerful influences on education. So again, I'll begin my reading and then we'll hope that I can pace myself well enough to go through the slides. Educational needs in the American colonies varied by regions, and we'll be talking about three primary regions: northern colonies, middle colonies, and southern. Each was unique in nature. Northern colonies were pretty much cohesive. It made it easy then to have a public school system eventually. Middle colonies were influenced by many, many groups, religious groups, and the various norms that they had from their own cultures and societies. The southern area was influenced mostly by Anglicans and the divided society that began back then. To some degree, we're still seeing those kinds of influences throughout the education system. Certainly through the 1950s, we saw those kinds of things. We'll also be touching a little bit on that new area, the new frontier called the Northwest. And the Northwest at that point was certainly very far east for most of us, but we'll work our way through that. Though particulars were unique to each locale, one prominent thread ran through all of them: the union of education and religion. While education unquestionably provided the foundations for social, commercial, and political activity, the colonists were primarily interested in how it promoted the practice of their religious beliefs. With that goal in mind, the scriptures and their truths were an integral element in the educational process. The scriptures guiding Protestant American colonists were contained in the King James Bible. As we look at this overall, I'm going to let it stay there as a kind of guide as I read through this. But again, the primary influence, Puritans, and I'm probably telling you more than I really remember, but if we think about the Puritans, they were the ones who hoped to reform the Anglican Church from within. The Pilgrims were those who were more conservative and really, I think, had given up on Reformation, and so that kind of sets things for us as well. It's an important thing, too, to keep in mind that within this group overall, clergy and teachers were in that rare, enviable position of being the most educated citizens within a community, and that's outstanding, especially if we compare it today when teachers are among the most reviled, I think. The standards, too, for teachers were probably as high as they were for pastors within that area as well. Part of what happens then within this group is the fact that we want to be able to read, and so that's going to require an education system. And the primary reason for doing that is that reading is the key, the window, the door to salvation. And so if you can't read, you're in deep trouble, I think. One of the most influential people throughout this time was Cotton Mather, and so I think we need to look at him too. There will be several slides related to him. But again, this gives us a good background for the northern colonies. If we look at the laws that are a part of this as well, there were two laws 5 years apart, as you see, but it's almost incomprehensible, I think, sometimes to think how far advanced they were. They were a very organized people. And so the law passed in 1642 was primarily general, certainly represented all of the needs of education, and began to provide a plan for that in a very formal way. Within 5 years, the Old Eluder Satan Act, which may be one of those things that clings to our memory, specified some aspects of education. And so for these households, 50 communities that had 50 households or more, they were at least encouraged to provide formal education for their children. For those communities with households of 100, there was a greater push because they were to organize grammar schools with the goal of preparing students for Harvard. So as you can tell then, certainly we have a situation by 1647 that requires a trained teaching staff with the Old Eluder Satan Act. Let's talk a little bit about Cotton Mather. If you remember anything about New England, especially during the colonial times, you remember the powerful influence of the Mather family, three prominent men: John Mather, Increase Mather, and then Cotton Mather, who was pastor of the Old North Church. He was not given to a timid spirit. Almost anything that you read in any of several short books or articles is pretty much in your face. He was not afraid to say what he thought. So let's look for a minute at what he did say in the education of children. And I'll read this, I think, for emphasis as we go along. "A good school deserves to be called the very salt of the town that hath it. And the pastors of every town are under peculiar obligations to make this a part of their pastoral care." Interesting concept. "That they might have a good school in their neighborhood. A woeful putrefaction threatens the rising generation, barbarous ignorance and the unavoidable consequence of it. Outrageous wickedness will make the rising generation loathsome if it hath not schools to preserve it." And you can see a kind of collective rolling of eyes if we were to say anything remotely like this today. Powerful kind of statement, though. If we think about him again, that strong influence just permeated the New England of his time. Great influence on every religious and social matter. Continuing this, "But schools wherein the youth may by able masters be taught the things that are necessary to qualify them for future serviceableness, and have their manners therewithal well formed under a laudable discipline, and be over and above well catechized in the principles of religion, those would be the glory of our land and the preservatives of all other glory." Can you even conceive in today's world of any pastor wielding this kind of authority, at least in a positive way? We can sometimes see people from various fronts that criticize, but he is certainly letting them know how he expects his community to be run. Fascinating to go back to that. Okay, now let's move to the Middle Colonies. As I said, the Middle Colonies were settled by a variety of people. And so you had then persons from varying religious views, more often Catholics, I think, in a prominent way, and the various national values that they brought. In some cases, it was difficult to separate the national from the religious values in those times in particular. The other thing that I want to point out, too, is the influence of the Society of Friends, because we live in a part of the country where almost no one even has known a Quaker or a Friend. Their values are solidly in place after many, many years of influence. They settled primarily in the Middle Colonies, but they also settled in the New Frontier. They're known as one of the historic peace churches, and powerful influence, great value placed on education, especially the non-programmed type of Quakers, pretty much known as intellectuals, those persons who were movers and shakers, and we think of such people as William Penn, and we think of his influence, especially in Pennsylvania. The Moravians first appear in this paper, and again, let's look at them because they are a group unfamiliar to most of us. Hard for us to believe, unless you are familiar with them, that they are sometimes called the pre-reformers, certainly among the earliest reformers. And we're going to talk a little bit about why we may not know very much about them. So if you think about this overall, 60 years before Luther nailed the theses, 95 theses to the door, they're known, and I'm getting ready to use my Midwestern corruption of Latin, but I believe that is unitas fratrum, known as the unity of the brethren, sometimes known as brethren, or and I think just brethren or united brethren probably does a disservice to it, because this is a whole network that is both formal and informal. They have a very simple profession of faith. It would probably be more simple than many church covenants in a Baptist church. It's considerably less formal than any of the mainline churches. It's a matter of just agreeing with each other that these kinds of things are held in common. You heard yesterday the connection to Wycliffe, and certainly all of us remember that. We sometimes don't remember Jan Hus or John Huss, who was a Czech reformer, followed Wycliffe, martyred for his ideas in 1415. And the goal of Moravians among all organized groups in particular was to provide the scriptures in the language of the people. So part of what happens with them then is that sometimes they would move into areas, or they would arise out of a particular area where they were, and they were rather quiet people, very modest, humble people, really very simple goals to introduce the gospel to anyone who could read it, and to train those who couldn't, because that was another one of their goals. Okay, if we think about this too, some of you are familiar with Moravian influence on John Wesley, and I'm going to do a little side trip here, too. You may remember, if you are familiar with John Wesley, that he was part of a group of people who sailed by ship to Georgia. And among those were Moravians. And the leader of the Moravians was Nicholas von Zinzendorf. And Wesley, at the time he was in this country, really was a poor soul in many respects. He had come, if you're familiar with his statements, after being here for some time, he said something roughly like, "I came here to lead people and I myself am lost." And so as he sailed back to England, he left a defeated man because he hadn't been successful in the mission in Georgia. He hadn't been successful in love. He had found a young lady here that he admired very much. She didn't share his views of their friendship. So he went back kind of beaten down. There was a storm on board of the ship, and Wesley observed the Moravians kind of clustered singing hymns and not being disturbed in any way by what was going on. Later on, he had a conversation with von Zinzendorf and talked to him about concepts of salvation, and it was probably the words that von Zinzendorf planted that stayed with him as he returned to England. Part of within probably a year of that time, maybe longer than that, Wesley, still searching for some sense of assurance, went to Aldersgate Chapel. And while he was reading not the Book of Romans, but Luther's preface to the Romans, he felt his heart, quote-unquote, strangely warmed. So those kinds of things, I think, are important to think of the powerful influence that Moravians had, and it was all without fanfare. Even today, especially today, you won't find any fanfare. There were several settlements, one in northeastern Ohio, about an hour and a half south of Akron, and it was known, and I called the librarian in this town to be sure that I could pronounce this, regardless of what it looks like, it is pronounced Gnadenhütten. And so that there was a mission, a Moravian mission, to Native Americans. They were extremely evangelistic. They were always seeking those people who were marginalized. So again, if you put that within the context of trying to have an informed laity, trying to make sure, again, that the scriptures are known to everybody. Remember their theme of bringing the scriptures to all people in their native tongue. We talked about the Northwest at that time, too, and we'll talk in just a minute about the Northwest Ordinance. But there was also a settlement in southeastern Illinois, not very far from Evansville, and it was known at various times as Salem and West Salem, and finally they decided that since there was a Salem in North Carolina, that West Salem was to be the name of that small community. It's an interesting thing because I don't want to overreach when I'm talking about language in their native tongues and assuming that everywhere they went, someone made sure that the scriptures were in English, but it specifically said that the English language was the first language in West Salem. Later on, Germans came, and so it became then what we typically associate with Moravians. But I think what we have to do is almost to look at it from the standpoint that their basic goal, wherever they went, and that includes English-speaking countries, they wanted to make sure that everyone had access to the scriptures in their native tongue. They were basically associated with Germans, and in many cases we assume that they were Germans, and again, they were not. They were from the area that is now kind of the Czech Republic. So I think, again, it's important to kind of keep those distinctions there. Throughout this country, though, they typically settled in areas where there were Germans. They had a particular fondness for reaching Native Americans. So if you think, then, by 1735, they were beginning to be rather widespread, and it's almost incomprehensible to me to think of this kind of influence overall as a background to their influence within this country. The fact that they were spreading throughout Europe and had come here very early on. So if we recap just a little bit, parents took the responsibility to provide education for their children, and especially to form their Christian character. I don't know about you, but I almost forget that at some point Sunday school was not as we see it at Lifeway or any other publishing house, but that it was an inner city ministry to minister to those who were certainly marginalized, the very poor people of London. And so even before that, the Moravians were there, not with any particular organization, just simply making sure that people everywhere were taught the basics. And if you think about the extensiveness of this, it resembles a lot of what we do in today's Sunday schools in particular, with teaching doctrine, music, and hymns of the church. Sometime, if you love music, rich church music, there are a good many hymns that owe their origin to Moravians. One of the hymns I think that is attributed to von Zinzendorf is "Jesus, Thy Blood and Righteousness, Thy Beauty Are My Glorious Dress." And if I were smart enough and had a better memory, I could give you more of that. But again, powerful people to think about. Okay. And I'm going mostly by slides after all. So if we think about it, too, again, a lot of slides on the Moravians. But they were driven to share their faith with every possible person. Again, we're talking about roots that go back to Wycliffe, Jan Hus, with the idea that all of that permeated their ministry from that point on. Pretty revolutionary people, and for a group that doesn't have a well-formed creed, actually is not a confessional church at all, they had some pretty strong opinions. I almost didn't include this second bullet, but it represents a point. Sometimes it's confusing to go back and look at translations of the scriptures, because we see that a certain Bible or a portion of the New Testament is published earlier than these times. And so we want, in many cases later too, but the idea was that some, you have to read carefully the footnotes, I think, because some of those were published from the Latin, some were published from the Hebrew, some were published in English, and in this case, early on, this was translated from the original languages, but into Czech. I think a thing that is important with this, too, a kind of side story that is fascinating. Moravians are passionate about their faith. And when this Bible was published, various people who were not their friends caught wind of that. And to preserve copies of the scriptures for later generations, the women hid them in loaves of bread so that they could have preserved those copies and they would not be threatened at all. So again, one of the most powerful groups of people, and we don't know very much about them unless we really want to. Another person that some of you are familiar with because of history of education, history and philosophy of education, is Comenius. Comenius was a bishop in the Moravian Church. He was also, by any definition, a reformer in education. If we look at him overall, here is a man whose name, again, is not very familiar to anyone. We think about how early he influenced education in this country. One of the things that is important, too, is that he was offered the presidency of Harvard, and he refused that. And I think Tom's second presidency of Harvard. So here's a guy that, you know, you would never connect. Can you imagine this name within all of those grand English names? And here is Kamensky. So, but if you look at him, he was one of those persons, and this is one of those points that I really do want to go back overall to the written text. I think he would be considered a building block, or his views would be considered a building block of early American education. If we were trying to define his philosophies today, they are compatible with terms like progressive, multisensory, holistic, engaged learning, and this happened all of these years ago. And I think his sense, too, that children were different from adults and that they needed special attention. Some of his philosophy might have been common to some of Montessori's techniques. We're talking again about a man who had a huge grasp of human nature and the needs of young children. And so he later on published a book, which was revolutionary in its time, a book of words and pictures that were to show every student, to expose every student to the real world. And as a result of that, again, books were not plentiful back then, and certainly not books of this quality and of this scope. So it's a powerful thing to consider the influence that he had and the fact that after all of these years, 400 plus years, that his views would be familiar to us. I guess I'd like to think of them as Moravians, as stealth Christians, and maybe that's a strange term, but I'm not sure that it is. Overall, they tend, again, to be humble people. One of the leaders in the Moravian Church included the statement at the top in one of his addresses. He borrowed it from those of us who remember Paul Harvey and smile. But Harvey was describing the state of the Christian church probably in the 1970s, 1980s, with a huge emphasis on public conversions and baptisms and confirmations and all of the things that are a part of that. And the thing that really describes Moravians probably more than anything else is that they truly were interested more in conversion and making disciples than in membership. If you want a recipe for disaster, you want to consider that last bullet. After all of these years, church membership is pitiful. 50,000 in the U.S., 162 churches, most of which are extremely small, and a worldwide group of only 700,000. This is not the kind of person you want to come for a weekend on church growth. It is the antithesis of that kind of thing. But the important thing to them was not that, not the externals, but that they would come into a group. They did the same kind of thing happened with Wesley and with others. They influenced those people. They converted some, were instrumental in conversion and discipleship, but it wasn't important for them to say anything about who they were or the influence they had on particular people. Okay, why then, with all of this stuff on religion, why are these people important? Because in some ways we may never know the influence they have had on education in this country, because they moved into communities virtually no one knew about them, with their goals of educating young children, forming character, and making sure that various groups had the scriptures in their own tongue. We won't know that influence. There's an interesting story, too, that takes place in the South, where, at least by one account, and probably several, a group of Moravians intentionally sold themselves into slavery so that they could identify with the needs of the blacks in this country. It's hard to even conceive of that kind of thing, but it gives you a huge sense of their commitment to humankind and to ministering to everyone. Because in that time, certainly in the South, there was no chance for a slave unless a Quaker or a Moravian happened to come in. There was no chance for an indentured servant, for the most part, unless it was through the ministry of the Quakers and the Moravians. Question about this as we go on, I'm happy for you to jump in. Okay, now let's move into the southern colonies with the idea that we again have had in northern colonies influence of Puritans, cohesive society, homogeneous society, easy to set up public schools. In the middle colonies, we have diversity, no hope really of having anything other than probably religious schools, fragmented attempts probably for public schools. And now in the South, we have something that happened back then that still shapes, in some cases, the old historic view of education in this part of the country. So there were wealthy landowners who had large plantations, and they needed cheap workers. And so slaves came, hard to believe, as early as 1619. Some of you who are historians, it's not hard because you know that. But indentured servants also came during that time. Some of them were white, maybe most of them were white. And as you remember with them, the landowner paid for their transportation and their care, and that covered their coming to work for that landowner. So it was very much in this part of the country, education for those who had money, those who had prestige. One of the things that happened in the South was the SPG, and it's much easier just to use the abbreviation than the entire term. But Thomas Bray was responsible for the founding of that. And it's another one of those situations that we rarely hear about. Unless we really like educational history, we're not going to know much about this kind of thing. So here were charity schools for all of those whom today we would consider marginalized. And so here's an opportunity then for education. Now, what's the common thread of all of this? They're driven by scripture. They're driven by their relationship to God. And during this period of time, again, we're talking mostly about the King James Bible. The group that probably would have been separate from them would have been the Catholics, who would have used their own versions of the scriptures. So again, as we try to summarize that particular influence of the Quakers and Moravians in the southern colonies, two groups about whom we know very little overall. Okay, let's bring in that new territory, the new frontier, Northwest Ordinance of 1787, and it carves out, or at least makes possible to carve out, new states. It specifies the number of states, how they are to be admitted, and then there is included in that a Bill of Rights. Hard to believe in today's world that this kind of thing would ever have happened, and it forbids slavery. But the important thing for us, too, is that there is priority on education. Article 3 in particular, and this is something that we have forgotten as a society, especially the last part of this statement. Morality, religion, morality, and knowledge being good to good, being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall be forever encouraged. Shall forever be encouraged. Powerful statement, I think, and again part of the Northwest Ordinance, 1787. Now let's look at some of the books or some of the written kinds of influences. In many cases, most cases, they were books. But most of you have heard somewhere of the New England Primer, so let's talk about that for just a second. It held sway for a long period of time, from almost 1700 through the end of the 19th century, authored by Benjamin Harris. Hard to believe, even back during those times when printing was expensive and when presses were not all that plentiful, that 5 million of those books were published during that period. And a familiar theme to us, New England, fear that if a child can't read the scriptures, they are doomed, they are damned. And so it's important to make sure that we provide a knowledge of the scriptures, a knowledge of the Christian way of life. As we look at this too, it was just a very abbreviated introduction to the things that we would consider important today, but it included what they would have thought were essential and maybe what we think are essential today. And you see a catechism that is included in this. I'm going to show you a copy in just a second, or a facsimile. But most of us are familiar. Sometime we've heard that last bullet that, to represent the letter A in Adam's fall, we sinned all. And if I wanted to be accurate, I probably would say we sinned all. B, thy life to mend, this book attend. And so there were simple, rhythmic ways for children to remember the scriptures. I think that's an important thing, too, that the cadence of the King James Bible in particular lends itself to memory. There's just a rhythm. The hymns, the Psalter that was used in a lot of primitive Presbyterian congregations in particular in the Northeast, all of these things came from there. And so you have then this outline, really a pretty appealing outline. You can't read it, and I wish you could, but it was attractive, pretty novel, and if you think about those being wood carvings, not a bad effort at all. Okay, the Horn Book, not really a book. It was an educational tool. If we really wanted to stretch things, we would say that it was the equivalent of today's iPhone or something similar to that. Not really. But it had just the very basics. It included just the basics. The reason it was called the Horn Book was because, if we look at it here, I'll wait until some of you are taking notes. If we think of vowel consonant combinations, we still do those kinds of things. We do those whenever we're talking about phonological awareness today. We break things apart. We put them back together. They were doing some of that back then. The fact, too, that this contained the Lord's Prayer certainly reminded every student everywhere of what they were to be about. And so we see a little girl. It looks, it's just really a board with a handle with, looks more like a broad paddle than anything else. And the reason, again, it was called a horn book was that very thin layers of animal horn that were more translucent than anything else protected those kinds of copies, which would have been hard to replace. You see in the middle of this, In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, I think in some instances there was a doxology perhaps included in those, but you see the copy there of the Lord's Prayer. And for the influence of the Anglican Church, it says trespasses rather than debts. So, okay, the American Spelling Book, Noah Webster. The common term for the American Spelling Book was the blue-backed speller. It included those themes that are common, again, almost every type of educational approach would have included something that made a clear distinction between good and bad. But I think it's important, too, to go back and realize that the instruction that was used, as primitive as we might consider it today, listening and recitation, so memory, recall, something that is hardly considered today, with the idea, too, then, that we incorporate really all of the language areas as a part of this. A fragment, but I like that one better than the ones that are more intact. McGuffey readers. I can't think of anything that probably was more influential, at least up to probably the turn of the century. Presbyterian minister, and you could expect then that it had strict moral lessons. He was also, and some people don't remember, that he was also a professor at Miami University. And again, you see those heavy moral themes that a child is to be prompt, good, kind, honest, and truthful. And you look at broader themes that relate to attitudinal changes in students, or at least a check on attitudes, something that we probably wouldn't dare do much today. So a powerful kind of influence there. And I'm trying to be conscious of time because we are getting there. Cover of that, and if you want to see notes, I'm happy to go back over these if you'll stay just a bit. Just the cover of McGuffey, six different readers over time. So if we tie all of this up then, I think it isn't a huge stretch, to believe then that the King James Bible covered virtually every aspect that today we would consider important, because it certainly provided the content. Those who were leaders that we've talked about developed curriculum from that. In many cases, the Bible itself was one of the materials, but certainly materials taken from that. Almost everything, again, that we think of today that might be important, especially in elementary ed, is contained in under that third bullet. It was a time then when communities and institutions were really formed from that influence.